This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Aaron Bedra, CTO and Chief Scientist of Gemini, a security consulting firm in Chicago. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, so I've been in the software and security world for quite a while now. I really couldn't make up my mind whether I want to do software and security, and I kind of do a bit of both worlds all the time. So I've spent my career building software, breaking things. I spent a little bit of time in language development with the Clojure language.
And what is it that you do at Gemini?
So a wide range of things. Gemini focuses on software security, consulting services, governance, executive consulting, and the security realm, kind of a mixed bag of things. Personally, I'm providing virtual CISO services to a number of companies. I'm helping them build some security-focused software. And then also kind of helping out on things like DevOps with securing cloud environments, building out encryption pipelines, and kind of securing credentials, IAM management, that kind of thing. So a mixed bag of just about everything.
Yeah, that's quite broad. So you really haven't made up your mind between...
No, I haven't.
How long has that been going on?
Since the early 2000s, I haven't made up my mind. So it's been a little bit of everything from building systems to breaking systems to understand entire system design and management and architecture, kind of a bit of everything.
Do you have one that you like more, or are you kind of past that and you just have to...
I don't have anything I like anymore, right? Everything has its own charms and qualities. And of course, drawbacks. So I've gotten paid to write code in just about every popular language under the sun, and some not so popular languages as well.
Right, so tonight we're going to primarily talk about threat modeling and what that means. Can you explain what you consider threat modeling to be?
Yes. So threat modeling is a very loaded term. Industry has a lot of definitions, but I try to keep it very simple at looking at a system from a holistic standpoint. What does it look like? How does it connect? And what protocols does it speak? In terms of foundational levels. And then I think about the assets and controls on the system. So what assets are at play? How are they being transferred? And what controls do we have in place to prevent those assets from being misused? And then on top of that, I think about presenting bad actors in scenarios around the assets, so we understand what could they do, were they to attack a system. And so you battle the foundation, and then after the foundation, you take a look at, how would I break in? And then every time we find something that's a likely scenario that actually poses a business risk as well, we start to think about how that could impact the business and what the result would be. And it's very common that people will do threat modeling and think about a technical vulnerability that has no actual business impact or risk. Or very little, right? Something not worth considering. And so I think it's really incredibly important to include risk assessment in the threat modeling landscape, so that you kind of understand not just what the vulnerabilities could be or what the design flaws could be, but also how could the company have a loss event as a result of that.
I watched a presentation by you from a conference earlier this year, and you referred to types of security. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah, it really comes down to what you're securing. I think there was, in the initial presentation, there were two categories. And we can expand from there as well. But, at the end of the day, you're protecting something. And if you keep asking why, you'll get to the very end of the trail. And effectively, it's loss of money or loss of life. I tend to focus in the private sector and the business world where loss of money is the focus. I haven't spent a ton of time where loss of life is a concern, and I'm fortunate and happy not to. I would have a guiltier conscience on my shoulders because software fails, right? And so I tend to focus more on the loss of money type of security or category of security.
You also talk about how to assess the scale of a threat. There are things that are large threats, small threats, and they shouldn't be treated equally. But how do you go about assessing what's big and what's small?
Certainly. So first of all, it goes back to the business. How could it impact the business? You could have a very capable, very large threat actor, a nation state, somebody very powerful. But if there's nothing to lose, there's nothing to lose. And so I think how big has to consider first, what's the impact? How big could the impact possibly be? Then you talk about, you know, the capability and the intent of the threat actor. And so, you know, when I think about threat actors in the private space, a lot of times they're crimes of opportunity, right? There's organized crime groups of going after certain targets. Think about things like fraud in the retail commerce space, fraud in the banking space. You think about, you know, misuse of stolen data. So password breaches, stealing of databases, or stolen credit card breaches, things like that, where you kind of misuse an asset to gain something else. But, you know, the end result really when it comes to money is mostly fraud related. And then the other side of that, of course, is the theft of credentials to get you to get to fraud. But the end goal at the very, you know, end state of what everybody's doing is they're trying to steal money. The money stolen usually by means of fraud in one way or another.
But then, you know, you're kind of implying that if your company doesn't handle money in some way, or if a break-in occurred and accounts were compromised, that doesn't result in money, you're not likely to be attacked? Is that fair?
You know, so likely to be attacked is a different story, right? Everybody's being attacked all day. The scope and severity of the attack is different, and I think we'll get to that soon. But in terms of value, right, data is also incredibly valuable. Who you are, any information about you, non-public personal information, social security number, combined with your first and last name, address history, work history, phone numbers, things that kind of help identify you. That data is what people are really after, along with credit card information and things like that. But the more information somebody can get, the more likely they can use that in a way to basically steal, right? Because stealing somebody's personal information is a privacy issue, and you know you are responsible for that as a company if you disclose that information unauthorized or unintentionally, and so there'll be an impact to you. But you know they're not stealing it just to have it; they're stealing it to use it, impersonate you, sign up for credit card accounts, get healthcare, all kinds of things, right? You know, there's a next step to this, and I think that's the most important part. There are categories where money's on the wire, right? You have retail commerce, you have banking, you have anywhere where, you know, transactions take place or money changes hands. There's a direct line of fire for money, but, you know, it doesn't mean that a medical site, a health insurance company, doctor's office and hospital network, a breach there could be just as catastrophic. Cause you can replace a credit card number, but you can't replace a social security number or personal information once it's breached.
Yeah. On that point, you mentioned sort of, thereafter non-public information, but at this stage Yahoo's had 3 billion accounts compromised, LinkedIn's had an enormous number of accounts compromised, Equifax here in the US. This information, you can't really consider it private anymore. Addresses, phone numbers, social security numbers, dates of birth, bank accounts, credit cards.
Yeah.
So are we kind of, I don't know what the term would be, past or post security at this point? You know, does it really matter if my information is now stolen from Twitter because it's already been stolen 5 times already?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of a running joke, right? Yet another service is offering you free credit monitoring because you probably already have 4 others you signed up for. So it is unfortunate. Almost every person has been affected by privacy.
But is that going to impact the value of the attacks in the sense that Is there a big honeypot to attacking something that's going to get social security numbers when we know they've already been compromised? So what you really need to get your hands on now is the massive torrent with all the information from Equifax, if it's out there.
Yeah. And so that information will end up being disclosed at some point, but actually what's going to happen is they're going to sell that information. Right. And so, you know, you can buy the information and use it. There's an economy of scale at a certain point where you buy enough and you get enough information and you can do enough damage. You could also, create an attack of your own that gets at you that data for free. Right? There will always be attacks like this that tell us, People are still looking for this data. They either weren't able to access it or didn't have the money to buy it. And so they're always after that. And of course, as people are born, as new people come into the system, they're going to have new chances to do these kind of things. And so every day, how many new credit cards get created? And every day, how many people are old enough now to have credit accounts and have health insurance and different things when they're of a certain age that they're able to qualify for mortgages and, you know, big ticket items in terms of credit that allows people to steal.
You made a comment earlier that everyone's being attacked all the time. So yeah. I'm going to bring it back a little bit to the software developer. So if I'm a software developer for a small or medium company and I'm building software and it's publicly facing, how often, I know it's a difficult question to answer, but how often is it likely to be attacked?
So I'm going to use a broad definition of attacked or loose definition of attacked, but all the time. So if you, for example, if you were to put up a web server with a single page, just a plain HTML page, and you looked at the logs over a few days of time, you're going to see scripts trying to analyze what's on that web server. Even though you may not have made it public, you may not have told anybody about it, you just turned it on. That's all you did. Right, you're going to see people looking for certain URLs that they know to be administrative portals. You're going to see really odd request strings, really odd different like pieces of information being like showing up in the logs, and those are all signs of people looking for vulnerabilities. And so there's people all over the world scanning systems 24 hours a day to try to find what I call crimes of opportunity, right? Just a drive-by that happened to find something neat, and then they go deeper, right? And so there's a whole world of misconfigured systems out there that are being used, they're being compromised, then used as fodder for criminal intent, basically, right? As we have EC2 and Azure and Google Computes, there are systems that are designed like that, elastic computing, that are made entirely of compromised systems for you to send out botnet attacks on. And you pay for them just like you do EC2 or Google Cloud or Azure. You pay with Bitcoin or some kind of, you know, anonymous quote unquote currency. But there's systems already like that that are just composed of, you know, crimes of opportunity, right? Drive-by download compromised things. Most of them are, for better or for worse, they're PHP systems, right? WordPress, Flex, things that are running interpreted, you know, scripts that are executed, usually misconfigured running in a root account, and then they're taken over and then kind of used as a command and control worker.
All right. So if what you're saying is, if I put software up there, I'm going to be attacked.
That's right.
So then I have to start identifying the potential risks. How do I go about doing that?
So the first thing, and I tell people always to start here, is figure out the business impact. The technical stuff doesn't matter yet. What you really might need to understand is, what are you securing? Right. I ask people this every day, and that's not just developers. It's security people. It's hardened, seasoned security veterans. I say, what are you protecting? And I get a technical answer, right? Or I get something that isn't really related to, what their real job is. Or it's simple things like, oh, I'm protecting against loss of data, which tells me they don't actually understand what they're doing. And so, you know, my strongest advice in this category is, go to the business, learn the business well, understand how the business works. And what it stands to lose. Until you do that, you really can't truly understand security well or how to implement security properly. Because we only have so much money and time in our budget, and security is not our core business for most companies, right? And so you want to spend as little money and time on security as possible, but also have the biggest impact. And you can't do that unless you understand the business.
So if we were to take an example, let's say some sort of a medical medtech company, you'd say their database isn't what they're protecting. It would be the personally identifiable information, which they would be fined for if it leaked out, is what they're protecting.
Yeah, and it's really the protected health information, the PHI that they're after. Mm-hmm. That's where you get fines, right? HIPAA is going to go after PHI and disclosure. And you know, a healthcare company, you picked, you know, the richest example because there's so much there, right? Even accidental disclosure has an effect on a healthcare organization, right? Simply revealing the wrong thing to a valid user is enough to trigger notification, right? So the HIPAA data breach, our data security laws are so aggressive that, you know, it's a very, very interesting world where, you know, just simply having something in plain text in the wrong spot is a findable offense. And so, yeah, I mean, it's interesting in terms of that. And also, medical records, a medical record breach is about twice the industry average, cost per record when you're talking about actual breaches. Because you not only find, you're fined from HIPAA, you have credit monitoring, credit protection, but there's usually a lot of, follow-up that happens, from the regulators. If you operate in multiple states, you have every single state has, you know, their own disclosure and notification laws. There's really the landfall from that is actually quite huge.
And who's auditing that?
So what's interesting enough is when you think about regulatory firms, right? In finance is a ton in the payment card industry. You know, PCI has their own auditors. The thing about HIPAA is there's not an official HIPAA auditor. You can go for certifications like HITRUST, which is one of the kind of healthcare standards for certification. ANAC as well is one of the kind of standards for certification. And they're going to ask a lot of security questions and kind of get you going. But it's not, you know, doing that doesn't mean that every healthcare organization has to accept that as your validity on security. It's simply a private company that, you know, can help attest that you're doing what they think you should be doing, right? And so there's no kind of one answer for healthcare organizations, which is why it's so difficult. And HIPAA itself has, you know, kind of those four basic tenets of data security. But it's very gray in a lot of areas. And so, it's big, it's broad, but it's also gray and it's kind of hard. You know, I understand why a lot of companies struggle with, you know, how do I really do HIPAA? Because there's not a really pointed guide unless you follow the HITRUST CSF or ANAC or one of those other standards bodies that are private and not widely accepted.
And then is there a sort of a cop who's going around checking these things, or is it usually the fines are in reaction to something that got public and became known and it's already too late?
In terms of HIPAA, it's mostly a post-breach scenario where HIPAA will take a look at what happens and they're gonna ask a lot of questions, and you know, you're fined per offense. But what's more important is how you're fined, the caps on how much you're fined are based on what you've done, right? If you were, for instance, willfully negligent, you knew about a security issue, it was public, you didn't fix it, and you had a breach from that, then you're going to have a lot more fines to deal with, it'll be a lot worse, right? If you had a really great system, you had all your certifications from HITRUST and ANAC and SOC 2, and you were ISO compliant, and you had a really great program, and so you still had a breach, you know, yeah, you're going to have a fine, but it's going to be much smaller because you had the diligence in place. And so really it's based on, you know, how diligent were you in building your security program? And, you know, it's kind of it's usually a post-breach thing. Or maybe you were reported by somebody saying, hey, oh, yeah, we think they're doing something wrong here. They might follow up, investigate, and ask questions. And, of course, if they find, you know, something as a result of that, you could be fined as well. But we also have to remember that the FTC in the U.S. has now gotten a lot of teeth. The FTC is now suing organizations for improper security and winning. And so data breaches that were, you know, found to be a pretty gross abuse of security and poor program planning, they end up being sued by the FTC, which is a very interesting turn. Over the last, you know, probably 2 or 3 years, it's been more prominent.
If you've gone to the business and you've identified in your whatever scenario it is, the information that you need to protect because it's going to put you out of business if you lose it, or it's going to result in large fines, how do you then start examining your own system to see if you will be resilient to an attack to protect that information?
Yeah. And so, you know, obviously once we know that, technical things are what come next. And I lump it into two categories. There are design flaws, which are system design issues. You have, for instance, maybe you design authentication, but part of your system wasn't ever designed to authenticate and it should have been, right? Those are security issues, but they're flaws in how you design. Or maybe you've encrypted a whole bunch of stuff in one place, and then you've put something in a box somewhere else that you forgot to encrypt. You know, these are system design issues. Then there are vulnerabilities. Vulnerabilities are bugs in code. Simply put, things like the Equifax breach, the Struts vulnerability, that's a vulnerability, right? It's a bug in code, one way or another, a logic issue. But you know, really, is when you think of bug, it's just a simple bug. They can be pretty devastating, but they're just bugs. But also just as bad. So you have to think about both the flaws and the vulnerabilities. And there are different ways of thinking about that and different ways of testing for them, right? So testing a design flaw is difficult. I usually use threat modeling as my vehicle to test or think about design flaws. And then I use the basic tools for vulnerability assessment that have been around for a long time. You know, there's static analysis, dynamic analysis tools that you put into the CI pipeline. And there's also outside or third-party penetration testers. You know, any company who is regulated is going to usually be required to do penetration testing. But I always recommend that even if you're not regulated, at least once you go hire a third-party penetration testing firm to give you an idea of what they find, what they see, right? Do you have vulnerabilities? Do you have things that they can find? They can even find design flaws in some cases, but they're going to focus on vulnerabilities, misconfigurations, that kind of thing.
I've heard of companies, or I know some of them do, they put sort of network monitors on their systems as well to watch data as it's flowing so that if all of a sudden a gigabyte goes out the door, they know something has happened.
That's right. So NetFlow and kind of exfiltration protection is very important, you know, if you have a lot of data to take. Right? If you only have a small amount of data, it's a few megs, you'll never see it leave. But if you had terabytes or gigabytes of data and all of a sudden, you know, one channel gets real fat all of a sudden, you know something's probably wrong. And so, yes, when you think about this, we think about it in terms of maybe classification of behavior. How do things normally operate? And if something doesn't operate as expected, what do we do? And, you know, that's just situational awareness. We do that in a lot of cases for just identifying if a system is performing like it's supposed to. General performance metrics, general KPIs for business. You know, they exist. We can create KPIs around security as well. How much, and really, you know, they're usually not geared towards money. They're geared towards certain identifications of the system of, you know, what's my regular network flow? How do I think about, number of visitors a day, failed logins, successful logins, you know, all kinds of things, velocity of traffic, all kinds of interesting indicators of what's going on.
But even when you do that, I think it was one of the Sony breaches where everything went out over HTTPS in very small lumps, let's say, which looked like legitimate web traffic, and it went out over a period of months. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, attackers have gotten very good at exfiltrating data and going undetected. And there are things you can do here, right? The companies will often install SSL proxies that actually decrypt the traffic. It's a planned and organized man in the middle attack against all SSL traffic to figure out what's going over the wire, right? If the company owns the data and wants to make sure it's protected, they bust the SSL or, you know, man in the middle of the SSL and look at the traffic. And then what they do on top of that is they'll put data loss prevention tools in place to scan the content and make sure no information that they know about or want to protect is leaving the company doors on authorization. And so it's kind of a combination of SSL forward proxying and DLP that help protect against exfiltration. And of course, encryption and then, you know, encryption anchors, right? Only being able to use the data in certain scenarios help an awful lot.
If you were advising someone that was building software, let's say a large application, and I came along to you and said, Aaron, help me build in security from the start. What advice would you give me?
Yeah, so I would give you a hug because that really is how it should be. So often security is tacked on later at a high price, right? It's not able to be worked in as deeply as it needs to be. You know, list goes on forever. But you know, to answer your question, it starts before you type a line of code, right? As we're thinking about what we're going to build, we're thinking about the data that's going to flow, where we're going to store it, and how we're going to protect it. And we think about it in terms of, or I think about it in terms of controls, right? You know, if I'm going to have a website and I'm going to have user information or personal information, I'm going to know right away I want to have authentication, right? And if there's information sensitive, I'm going to know that I want to have TLS So I want to have that configured properly. If I'm looking at passwords, right? I want to make sure I'm hashing those passwords in a way where if the date my password database is stolen, that I have a certain amount of time to protect my users until those passwords are inevitably brute forced, right? So the common misnomer is that if you hash it properly, it will never be broken, but it's just a matter of time.
Even with a good salting, hashing, and maybe even peppering?
Anything. You could have bcrypt or scrypt with a giant work factor that's unusable, but all you're doing is prolonging the offline cracking time. That's what you're doing, right?
The estimates you hear are sort of the length of the universe.
And so that's true for breaking encryption. In terms of hashing, it's not as true, right? You think about a straight SHA-1 or NB5, you can do way over a billion, 100, I think it's up to hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of hashes a second.
Oh.
There are people that build, those GPU rigs that people build for machine learning. You could apply those in the same fashion for doing basically generating hashes from known strings. It's insane how fast a password cracking rig can rip through a password database and decrypt, or not decrypt, but brute force. And so, because you're thinking of very limited term or limited length characters, right? 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, right? There's only so many possibilities.
On this point, when you start using something like LastPass or another password manager, which is going to give you a very pseudo random 20 characters, uppercase, lowercase, letter, numbers, special characters, will it last longer than a few seconds?
If you have a 64 character, INTP password, you're going to last longer. And chances are there's a value, right? If people are really truly doing this because they want to extract that password and use it, every account has a value, right? Think of a retail commerce site where you have a credit card stored on it, right? So that account, if you can log in, has a one-time value of just shy of $1,000. So anything more than $1,000 will set off the fraud alert. And anything under $1,000 will probably hit your bank statement. You go, what is that? And then you'll, say something. And so it's usually one-time use. And so you think of a value of a retail commerce account at around $1,000. So how much money would I spend to get that $1,000? And that's going to be compute time, right? How many computing resources would I spend, would I purchase to brute force that password? So if you hit a site with just plain SHA-1, the answer is you're going to get through it real quick and you're not spend much money. But if everybody's bcrypted with a work factor of 10 or higher and you're going to do each individual password, by itself, it's going to take you, it could take you 3 months per password, 6 months per password, 12 months per password. Now the value goes down. You think about the cost of an EC2 instance with GPU capabilities, how much does that cost for a year to run? And is that more than the account is worth? And so there's an economics play that goes on here and what's going on. And so, you think about a lot of the breaches, you also notice that they don't really have adequate password hashing. And so, you could protect yourself by doing that, but a lot of people won't, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and password are still really popular passwords. And or the name of the site.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I kind of derailed you. You were going through the various things and we got as far as passwords, good hashing, and
those are just examples, right? So thinking about that, how are you going to encrypt data? If you're going to store it, how are you going to deal with validation of inputs, right? It's super important. If you think about the OWASP top 10, there's a lot going on there, but one of the major things is validation of passwords or validation of user input, right? Are they sending me a SQL string versus a username? Are they sending me script tags instead of an address? How am I going to validate that input and make sure I don't execute that code unintentionally?
Yeah, unfortunately, and so, the more modern languages are taking care of that out of the box now.
That's right. And it's not the languages as much as it is the frameworks. The frameworks are building in.
The MVCs.
The ORMs have, escaping or parameterization of SQL queries by defaults. A lot of the templated languages have auto-escaping by default. And so people have put good options in place. doesn't mean that people won't turn them off in the name of getting something done. And you see it all the time. It's a massive thing of, you know, you have cross-site request forgery tokens, and then somebody's writing some JavaScript, and all of a sudden the form doesn't submit because that's CSRF error. So they just turn it off because that helps them get their JavaScript to work, and then they move on, right? And they don't realize the impact they've made.
Well, it was the answer to the question. It was on Stack Overflow. Just, you know, disable cores and I'll be fine.
And that's it, right? And there's a lot of that kind of advice on the internet. And I mean, to be honest, that's how we program now, right? People, like, as software engineers, the majority of us, you know, true or not, copy and paste a bunch of code from the internet. And that's how we program. You know, it's not bad, right? This is not a dig on writing software. It's just what we've become at this point, right? There are certainly people that are doing really amazing things without Googling. But Stack Overflow and sites like that, you know, GitHub examples, tutorials, sample code, that's the way of life now. And so anytime we have those kind of bad examples or bad advice, they get propagated. The Carl culting is very real here. And, you know, the more people that say thumbs up it or approve it or use it or repeat it, the more that information disseminates, and that's what wins.
What can be done about third-party libraries keeping up with patches? Because that was what happened with Equifax, or that's at least what part of what happened with Equifax.
Yeah, that was part of the story, right? It goes way deeper than that, but you know, it was definitely a very prominent part of the story, was a dependency vulnerability. And so there are a number of free tools out there. You know, Ruby on Rails has bundler audits. Node has the Node Security Project. OWASP has an array of dependency management checkers for different languages and frameworks, or I guess language package management systems. There are commercial tools. Sonatype has tooling. Things like App Canary, SourceClear. There's a whole bunch of stuff kind of dedicated to doing this now. But they're doing a great job with all this. And what you want to do is kind of build that dependency checking into your CI pipeline. Don't go to production when you have a known vulnerability. Or, you know, better advice is make sure that vulnerability doesn't affect you. So a lot of the free tools, they're going to tell you that the vulnerability exists. They're going to stop there. But there are tools out there like SourceClear that will say, oh, we've analyzed your source code and you are or are not affected by this, right? We've seen the method call to this vulnerable method that's referenced in the CVE. And so they're doing the entire chain to say, oh, you know, yes, it's bad, but don't worry about it. I mean, patch at some point, but don't stop everything. Or, hey, stop everything. This is really, really bad. You need to fix this right away. And so, you know, those tools, of course, they cost money, but they're very valuable, right? I suggest paying for things like that because they give you decision power that's actually way better than just do I patch or not. Because, you know, let's say you have it could take your system down and you lose revenue. And you don't know whether it's affecting you or not. So you have to kind of make a coin toss or an educated guess, you know, think about the possible loss, because one thing that's very important is availability is a security issue. People don't always think that's true, but it is, because lack of availability means a loss event. And that loss event will cost your company money. So if you have the exact advice, the exact information of you are affected by this or you're not affected, you can you can choose your patching strategy according to that information. And so I do advise companies to pay for for tools like this, because it gives them that decision power that you wouldn't otherwise have.
That, of course, is really only useful for companies that have gotten to the point of having continuous integration. And many of the companies that are bad at security don't have this.
That's correct.
You know, I've seen a company where C# files were dragged and dropped, uncompiled C# files were dragged and dropped onto IIS. And that was deployment of code.
Yeah, and so we can't forget about basic blocking and tackling, right? A repeatable build process, basic unit testing, basic static analysis, just for metrics, right? I can promise you that in most code bases I've ever seen, the areas with the highest like amount of complexity and lowest test coverage usually also had all the security issues, right? So remember that a vulnerability is just a bug. If you reduce the complexity, if you increase the test coverage, if you do the normal things to get rid of bugs, you will inevitably also get rid of some security issues here and there. Not all of them, but some of them, right? Because if in a set of all bugs, security issues exist. So less bugs, less security issues. And so basic software rigor is just as important as security in this case.
But let's say we've done all these things. We've got our CI, we've got our our tests. We've got the third party examination tools. You know, you can add more and more security. So there has to be a point at which you say, all right, that's enough.
Yeah. And this comes back to that risk question, right? How much do we have to lose? So, you know, your equation, when you think about your budget for security, year over year, you have to think about what you stand to lose, what's your potential impacts. And then on top of that, you want to think about what are you investing? Because if you're investing more than you could lose, you're doing it wrong. And so, you know, how much is enough is, you know, less than you need to spend, less than you would lose, really, is kind of like the initial number. And for companies that want to do it right, it should be significantly less than you want to lose, you think you're going to lose, right? It should be a small fraction of what you think you might lose. And so it's important to remember that risk is a range, not a number. Risk is guessing, right? We're doing our best to quantify risk. We're doing everything we can to get information in and make educated guesses, which is what they really are, right? And we'll use scientific methods to quantify, but without the actual precise number, the exact number, it is still a guess. And that's why we treat risk as a range. And so anybody that tells you the risk is X, they're lying to you, right? The risk is between X and Y. And we think that because, you know, here's all the information. And that's really what risk is. It's, I think risk is between X and Y, and here are the reasons why it is we've seen to support that. And so, you know, back to the question now is, you want to think about that range and make sure that you're spending less than that. And that means people, you know, think about all the salaries, think about the actual cost of vendors. It's the whole program, right? And also opportunity costs. Right? If you stand to lose $10,000 from a security issue, but you stand to make $100,000 from rolling something out, what would you do? You'd probably roll that thing out, right? Because you're going to make $90,000 even if you lose the full 10. You know, at the end, it's still a business proposition, right? And if the business doesn't exist, your security team won't either. And so it's always favor the business and find the right ways to do this and find a way to tolerate, accept, and nurture that risk.
Aaron, any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
I don't think so.
Well, Aaron Bedra, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thanks for having me.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Everything Else Will Fix Itself by Daniel Birch from the album Ambient Volume 1.